Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John-Mark Grodi, here at EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined by Elvis Gutierrez. He's a reaver to the Catholic faith. He came home to the church in 2012, around 2012. And we're really honored to have him here tonight to share his story. Elvis, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
It's great to have your brother on the show. You know, Catholic reaver, there's a lot there in your story, you know,
yes.
A lot, but, you know, as we were talking beforehand, you know, God uses all these things for his glory, you know, and to lead us on a journey, and then it gives us this great gift of being able to share it with others for comfort and encouragement on their journey. So thanks for being here.
Amen. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me step out of the way here. Go back to the beginning. Where does your story begin?
Okay. I'm going to preface it with just discussing about my parents. My parents are, you know, immigrants from the Dominican Republic. My father wasn't necessarily raised with the faith. You know, he didn't even get a real education. He made it to the third grade, and that's about it. And he was homeless from about 8 years old to about 16 years old. Then he was eventually adopted and came into the United States. My mother, on the other hand, like, she lived up in a country farm, and then she ended up, you know, moving with her father. She comes from a separated household, which in the 1950s, that's very, very rare, especially in a place like so traditional like Dominican Republic. But they eventually got married, they migrated here, and I was born in the United States. And the way that I grew up essentially, well, I didn't know because I was obviously a little kid and my parents were very ignorant, but we were in a forming side of town, I like to say it. It was a very pleasant side of town at one point, and it just started, you know, forming and going down a downward turn. And there was a lot of drug addiction within the neighborhood, people selling drugs in the neighborhood. And the older I got, the older I started saying, okay, well, this is not a pleasant place to live. And I recall being about 6 years old, and there were a lot of little plastic things all over the floor. And I thought they were parts of a cap gun, but they were actually cracked vials all over the floor. And I remember me and my friends would take them and pick them up and throw them at each other. And we just thought it was, you know, were toys. And my mom was... She didn't know what it was. She saw what cap guns were. She just probably assumed the same thing. You know, I don't know, no idea. But I lived in a place that it's a lot of immigrants that were there, a lot of Arabic people, a lot of Indian people. You know, there were people that were Hispanic in the neighborhood, some Italians in there. And growing up, again, I grew up poor on welfare, on Section 8, you know, food stamps. But I never knew I was poor. I always thought that, hey, this is just how people live. I didn't know. I was like, hey, there's Tang. And we just drink Tang and things of that nature. And as I grew up and I started getting a little bit older, I became enamored with hip-hop music. Yeah. I was completely infatuated with it. I have no idea why, because at first I liked Bon Jovi and I appreciated rock music.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, I began being very drawn into the hip-hop music. And the entire environment around me began to be shaped by it. You know, I would see people outside early in the morning, like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm maybe like 7 or 8 years old. And these guys are like rapping outside, you know, with the boombox not allowing you to sleep. And no one would really say anything. So by the time I was about 11, the neighborhood had already completely transformed. There were a lot of drug dealers outside. And even though there were a lot of drug dealers, they're actually very pleasant drug dealers, because I used to see them carry bags for like older women and say hello to the people that live in the neighborhood. And I'm assuming it's probably a way for them, okay, don't get me in trouble. I'll be nice to you. Just leave me alone. And just, you know, so the people within the neighborhood actually never said anything. They minded their business while the people were out doing what they needed to do. But then it started becoming worse and worse. And the neighborhood became slowly more violent and slowly darker. And my parents would take me on every single summer on occasion to the Dominican Republic, because my father just needed to go home. Mm-hmm. It's like he wanted to expose me and my sister to that kind of living over there. And as we went to the Dominican Republic, you know, I still maintained my faith because of my mom. And she's brought us to church every single Sunday. And I went through the sacraments and all these other things. And my mom would volunteer in our Catholic school. I was going to a Catholic school, and she would volunteer, you know, on bingo night. And she'd come back smelling like a bunch of cigarettes every single Thursday night. And, you know, she'd wake me up with a cigarette smell to say goodnight to me. And I appreciate, like now as a grown man, I appreciate that sacrifice so dearly. But as a kid, you know, you have no idea what's occurring.
Right.
So as I'm growing up, I saw my friends in the neighborhood and they started getting involved into like gang life and things like that and being influenced by other kids. But I had the fear of my father, because my father was such a big guy. Like, he was over 6 feet tall. And my father, when I was little, I used to think he was a professional wrestler. So I was pretty definitely afraid of him. But at a certain point in time, my father started going and traveling to the Dominican Republic by himself. So my mom was raising us primarily. So my father would be away for a few months. So my mom would have to work and she'd have to take care of the house and all these other things. So the people that I was looking up to and looking at as a symbol of manhood wasn't my dad because he wasn't there. It was the guys outside on the street. And that and professional wrestlers. I'm not even joking when I say that, you know. So now look at these guys and look at the fact that they would be able to stay out late and they did whatever they wanted to do. And I thought it was cool, you know, cool. And my downstairs neighbor, who was an older kid, he would tell me all the time, I never want to see you outside. Don't go outside. Don't stand out in the street. And he had a lot of respect from the guys in the street. Mm-hmm. So because he had that type of respect from people in the street and he'd tell me not to do it, I used to take his word and like, okay, I'm not going to be out there with the drug dealers. I'm not going to do whatever I wanted to do. And I just listened to my mom. So I had a little group of friends and I'd walk a few blocks away and I'd go visit them and whatnot. And they'd get into their little trouble and they'd do all those other little things. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, your dad's going to kick your butt. Even if he's in another country, I still had the fear of my father. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get in trouble with dad. Mm-hmm. But eventually I joined a youth group growing up. And there's a man named Anthony Felicissimo. You know, I call him Tony. And to this day, I still speak to him.
Yeah.
I love that guy. He would come around the neighborhood. And at first, people thought he was a cop. And as he'd come around the neighborhood, he would stop in the street corners and he'd talk to the random drug dealers and kids and everyone. He's like, hey, I want to talk to you. Come here. And everyone, because they assumed he was a cop, they all speak to him. And he was just trying to lead us to church. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to get us to join a youth group that he was forming within the parish, you know. And some of us answered the call. And this man, he was a saint. Mm-hmm. You know, he had knives pulled out on him. They spit on him. They ridiculed him. They've done everything you can name. They've threatened his life. You know, but he never stopped. He just continued. He was a father for many people that did not have a father, you know. And right now he's a really powerful pro-life advocate. But the people that he's a pro-life advocate, he's also a theology teacher, but his kids have no idea about his youth ministry past. And he guided us. So he was one of the main instrumental people in my early childhood that was trying to guide me and lead me to Christ, because I would go to church with my mom, but I had no idea what was going on. I was in Catholic school, did my confirmation. I still had no idea what was going on. You know, I just wasn't drawn into the faith in that way.
Yeah.
So I recall when I was a teenager, I'd go to church with my mom and I'd sit all the way in the back of the church. And as Mass would begin, my mom was in the front and I'd sneak out the back and my cousin lived two streets up and I'd go up to my cousin's house, play PlayStation for about an hour and then come right back in and sneak in. Yeah. So as that progressed, I saw my friends getting in trouble. You know, some of my friends were getting arrested. You know, my friends were getting involved into violence and things like that and drug use. But always in the back of my mind, I was like, you're going to get in trouble. Your father knows everybody. They're going to tell on you. And, you know, that fear of my dad kept me away from doing a lot of really bad things, you know. And they would invite me all the time. We're going to go fight in this neighborhood. Come down. And, you know, I would never go. So I eventually enrolled into college. I graduated high school, barely made it out of high school at that, you know. And I enrolled into college. As I enrolled into college, I dropped out after one semester. Then I waited for about a year. And then I dropped out again a second time. And after I dropped out a second time, I didn't know what to do with my life. I was completely lost. And as I was completely lost, a friend of mine had become an EMT. And I saw he was making about $300 a week. And I was like, man, that's big money, $300. You know, I was like, what I can do with $300 is serious. So I decided to become an EMT as well. And I signed up to become an EMT. I studied and I became an EMT around, I like to say July of 2000 or so. And I began working EMS. Then I started working for the city of Yonkers in EMS. And I always say that's the job that made me a man. Mm. Because you're not prepared. I don't care how much schooling you do. You're not prepared to see human suffering.
Yeah.
And you're not prepared for people screaming in your ear and all these other crazy things that occur. So as I worked in EMS, I started slowly developing myself as a man. But I still kept the entire friendship, my whole friend circle. And I had two groups of friends. It's the ones that had their fathers at home and the ones that didn't have their fathers at home. And the ones that didn't have their fathers at home, and I can only speak on my life, they all went to jail. And they all got in trouble. The ones that had their dads became lawyers and doctors, and they went mm-hmm. continued with school. And it's very strange. So at least in the moment, it was very strange because I had no idea about the you know, how what the lack of manhood can do in the home.
Right.
But as I worked in EMS the following year was 9/11, right? And as 9/11 occurred, I was injured at the time. You know, I had a shoulder injury. And I was laying in bed, and my cousin had called me up. He said, hey, there's something happening in the World Trade Center. A plane flew through it. And I was like, yeah, right, you're lying. I didn't believe him because the month prior, in August, I had gone to go see a girl down the World Trade Center. I'd never been there before, and she stood me up. And as the girl stood me up, I was able to enter actually into the World Trade Center, and I'm looking around. I'm like, okay, where is she? Where is she? And I just ended up going home, and I was upset. Like, I can't believe she stood me up. So when he said that, I thought he was trying to, like, make fun of me. And then my mom comes busting through the door, turn on the news, turn on the news. And then I see the plane hit, the second plane hit. And I stayed glued to the TV, and I called up immediately. I called the base. I'm like, I want to go help. Can I go help? And they're like, no, you're injured. You can't go, you know. And as everyone else saw the tragedy that occurred, and everyone was shocked, the following day, a friend of mine called me early in the morning. He's like, listen, I'm going down there. Do you want to join me? He had already been there 9/11. So it was now 9/12. And he's like, I'm going to go down there. Do you want to go? And I decided to say, yes, I'm going to go with you. I don't care if I'm hurt. I want to go. I need to do something. I couldn't just stay still in my bed. Yeah. So I ended up going there with him and my other friend, Irvin. And we drove down there. And at 9/11, you saw evil. You saw Satan. You know, you saw the most horrific parts of humanity. 9/12, you saw God. And it was probably one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had in my entire life. Unfortunately, it took something like that for us to really be able to have that type of experience. But we saw everyone from all types of different states, you know, showing up, and everyone just trying to support. And we weren't doing anything. You know, we were making a dent. You know, I recall being inside of a human conveyor line, lifting up buckets of rocks. And everyone's just passing buckets of rocks, and it meant nothing. Like, we weren't doing absolutely anything, but we just needed to do something to try to help.
Yeah.
And there were fire trucks that were stationed because they were afraid that some of the surrounding buildings would collapse. You know, so every time that they blasted their air horns 3 times, that means you needed to run out of the way. So, right, I was maybe about 9 or 10 hours into being there on location, and I hear the burr, burr, burr. Everyone starts running. I fall on the floor, and as I fall on the floor, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I need to go do something. I'm not coming back here because my shoulder was shot at that time. I was already hurt, and I was like, I don't care. I still need to go and help. So I ended up grabbing a piece of the World Trade Center, and I put it in my pocket. And I have it here with me, by the way.
Wow.
Yes. And this is my badge from when I was working EMS.
Wow. That's amazing, Elvis. What happened next?
Oddly enough, even though I saw death and I saw misery and I saw all these other things, and I was raised in a church and raised in a mom, and I was going to youth groups as a little kid,
right,
because of Tony, I didn't even think of God. Like, that was like the last thing in my mind. You know, I was just living day to day, you know. I was still enamored with hip-hop music. I was still enamored with my friend group. And they were really what I put in the forefront. I guess they were my God at the time. And then while working in EMS, I ended up meeting a girl. Mm-hmm. And she was my partner. And I quickly fell in love with this woman. And I didn't... At first, it was kind of a secret because she never really told me, but she was married. Mm-hmm. And even though she was married, she kept it from me... I like to say about like 4 to 6 months or so. You know, it was long enough that I know I was like head over heels for her, but she was telling me she was miserable, that she was separated. She was only with him because there was no other way for her to like move out. She didn't have the financial means to leave. And they had a child together. So she's like, if I could leave right now, I would. And, you know, I'm so sorry, but I have to stay here. So I ended up dating her for almost 2 years. But eventually she became pregnant from the situation. And she ended up having an abortion. And even though she had an abortion, I recall like it was yesterday, it's so vividly. We were sitting in her car. And as we were sitting in her car, you know, she's telling me I'm pregnant. And I was super happy. I was so ecstatic that she was. I was like, I can't believe we're going to have a kid. We're going to have a family, et cetera. And she's like, what do you mean you're going to have a family? You know, you can't support us. You know, and at the time I had injured my back. trying to save someone's life that I tried to commit suicide. So I was on workers' compensation. So she's like, how are you going to take care of us? And I already have a kid. And where are we going to live? We're not going to live in your mother's house. Like, this makes no sense. So I was like, I don't know. Just buy some time. Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. It's okay. Eventually, she didn't tell me. And she went and had the abortion. Mm. And I found out about a week and a half later after she had it. And she tells me, you know, you owe me X amount of money because I had an abortion. And I was like, no, I'm not going to pay you this money. And I recall getting into an argument with her. And oddly enough, this is something that I carried with me for many, many years. And I never said it to anyone. I never told anyone anything. You know, they'd ask me, oh, whatever happened to such and such person? And I was like, we just broke up. We faded away. I would never tell them. Like, after that point in time, our relationship completely was ruined. Mm. You know, it was never the same, you know. And I carried that wound. And it's so sad because so often we never speak about the wounds that the men carry from abortion.
Right.
You know, we understand that the women are victims as well, and we need to pray for them and all these other things, as well as the children. Mm-hmm. But we rarely ever speak about the men. And I carried this wound with me in my heart. And I actually have a tattoo because I always, in my heart, I always said it was a little girl. Mm-hmm. You know, I named the little girl, you know, I named her after the mother. And I have a tattoo here of a rose.
Mm-hmm.
And that tattoo, it says 2002, you know, to infinity. Because infinity to me is just God, you know. And there's no place for me to actually put roses. There's no tombstone for me to put a rose. There's no place mm-hmm. I can visit, you know. So I just, I tattooed that rose there, you know, just to remind myself, you know, that when I need to visit my daughter, like, she's by my side, mm-hmm. you know. And eventually, when we broke up, that abortion and that breakup, it broke parts of me that didn't even know existed. It completely destroyed me. And I was already away from the church at the time, so I had no reference of love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though my mom was present in my life, it just wasn't what I needed, you know. And I was completely lost and directionless. And as I was lost and directionless, I ended up eventually continuing my pursuit of music. I became very arrogant. I became a playboy. I became, you know, very full of myself, thinking that I was going to become a hot shot. I was like, I'm going to be the next super producer. I'm going to be the next guy winning a Grammy, you know. And then I eventually got involved with people that were actually Grammy winners. And I was like, I'm making it. My foot is right in the door, you know. And then people would give me attention because I knew all these people. And we're like, hey, I want to hang out with you because you know such and such person. And you're doing X amount of things. And I became a playboy. And the same exact way in which my heart was broken, I knew I was creating a circle of broken hearts as well, you know. And I'm sorry. And it ended up putting me in a darker place, you know, losing myself more and more and not caring about people's feelings. And now at this time, I had already witnessed so many people die from my job and working EMS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had my child die, you know, in this abortion. The person that I loved, that I was the only person I truly ever loved in relationship-wise, like, she had left me. So, like, my heart was broken and my dad had died as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, eventually, I just became a cold person, you know. And God was so good that even though I was a cold person and I was a womanizer and I was a playboy and I was going out to parties and I was living this crazy life out in the clubs, I ended up going to Dominican Republic to go see my sister get sacramentally married.
Wow.
And that same exact week, I had already like hung out with like 6 or 7 women within the course of like 4 or 5 days. I have no idea, you know. And then I met my wife, you know, a few days later. And as I met, well, she became the woman who would become my wife.
Yeah.
And she was the complete opposite of every single woman I ever dated because we're just broken people, you know, in a circle, you know. So every girl that I dated was broken and I was broken. And it was just, okay, we're just going around about that. That's what it appeared to be.
Right.
And she was the complete opposite. And God was first using my wife to help bring me back to him. And I had no idea. You know, I eventually proposed to my wife and she said, hey, I want to get married in the church. And I told her, listen, I'll marry you in a box. It doesn't matter. I'm a guy. We don't really need anything. You put a mattress on the floor, a TV in a refrigerator. As long as we have a shower, we're okay. You know? And she goes, no, I want to get married in the church, but you have to come. She was living in the Dominican Republic. She's like, you have to come here because my priest says you need to take pre-cana classes. And I said, I can't go there. I have a job now. I can't just randomly pick up and leave. And no, I have responsibilities. And she goes, well, we're not going to get married unless you come here. And I was like, no, we're going to get married. I don't know how it's going to happen, but we're going to get married. And she thought I was kind of crazy. And but thanks be to God, eventually we did get married. And as we got married, she ended up immigrating here to the United States. And we were married civilly, though. Mm. She wanted to be married sacramentally, so she wasn't receiving the sacraments. And I wasn't receiving it. I had no idea how long it had been since I had gone to confession or any of these things. Mm-hmm. You know, and oddly enough, about a month before I was married, I suffered a severe case of optic neuritis. And I had lost my eyesight and I was blind I was blind for almost 2 weeks because they had no idea what was going on with me. I wasn't completely blind. I was like legally blind. Mm-hmm. So for example, at the distance of where you are, I'd just see a shape. I had no idea what it was in front of me. You know, I just see a blob of colors and whatnot. And I needed, you know, help ambulating and walking and things like that. So they kept me in bed rest for quite some time and they kept me in steroids until my vision returned. And when I was with my wife, and I got married, she said, you know what, I'm so grateful that, you know, God helped you and all these other things. And I'm like, yeah, you know, sure. I never thanked God in the entire process of it. You know, like God was just an afterthought. So eventually my wife migrated here to the United States and we had a child. And this is so weird because this goes to show how like the seeds that were planted as a young kid, they never truly went away.
Right.
Because when I was lost to the world, I was an atheist for a while, you know, because I swore that I knew everything. You know, I was like, you know, this is just the imaginary man and Jesus is some random dude, you know. So I just didn't believe all the things that I was taught. But after I married my wife and we're having a child, you know, and we found out we were expecting a boy. And she said, what do you want to name him? I said, that's a good question. I don't know what we're going to name him. So my first name is Elvis, E-L, and her middle name is Angelina, A-N. Mm-hmm. So in Spanish, the letter I and Y make the same sound. Mm-hmm. It's like the letter E. Right. So it's E. So I said, okay, well, let's put his name Elian. L and Elvis and Angelina. Mm-hmm. Created this baby. So Elian. So I Googled it. And as I Googled it, it said it's an ancient Hebrew for God is family.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, really, God? I'm like, really? And she's bugging me every single Sunday to go to church. She was going to church with my mom, you know, but she was telling me, we need to get married in church. We need to get married to the church. You know, I want to receive, you know, the sacraments. And I was like, yeah, whenever. I'm already married to you. It doesn't matter. And then I had Tony bugging me and Tony's bothering me. You need to go to church every single Sunday. What are you doing? And I was like, leave me alone, Tony. I don't want to go to church. Right.
Yeah.
And eventually, as my wife was here and she was pregnant, my younger cousin, his name was Robert Arizaga Jr. Mm-hmm. We all called him Kenny. He was murdered at a Halloween mm-hmm. party. And he was such a good kid, such a modest kid. Like, he didn't bother anyone. He was an introverted kid. He was super extroverted with the people that he knew and that he loved. But if you just met him, like, he was a flower on the wall. Like, you would not be able to tell that he could even speak. Such an easygoing kid. And he never really went to parties like that. And he was invited to a Halloween party. And a gang showed up and they crashed the party and they stabbed him and killed him. And I remember the anger and the rage that I felt. And even though I wasn't necessarily that close to him, which is so odd, because I knew him, I knew he was my relative and I cared about him. But he's one of these relatives that you see like once a year, maybe twice a year.
Yeah.
You know, when I saw him growing up and I just remembered, you know, okay, he's dead. And I remember you in diapers. I remember you in your cartoon underwear, you know. And now you're no longer here and you weren't looking for the problems. You never look for problems. And now this happened. And as I was in his wake, I met a priest. And the priest was, oddly enough, cracking jokes. And he made everyone laugh. And he took such a somber, sad moment. And he just brought everyone, if their anxiety level was all the way up here, he brought it down here. And then he just started saying things. Hey, how many of you guys know about the Yankees? Who knows the Yankees starting lineup? And you know, a couple of people raised their hands. He goes, that's the sad thing. Because you guys know this Yankee starting lineup, but you know what time church is. You know what time they celebrate Mass on a Sunday. Like, we don't know that one, do we? Mm. You know, do you know what church you're supposed to go to? You know, it's like, I'm in this church over here. You're invited to go if you don't want to go. So I just found it so odd. I mean, I never heard anyone speak that way or preach, especially in a funeral of all places. Mm-hmm. And I introduced myself, and then I found out he knew Tony. Mm-hmm. And fast forward, almost a year later, one of my close childhood friends had developed cancer. And as he developed cancer, I was saying, hey, you know, if hell is real and all these other things, my friend might actually go to hell. I don't know what this is. You know, now, my friend, how can I say this? He made a boatload of mistakes, but he was such a loving, caring human being. Right. But he had done some very despicable things as well in life. It's just the environment shaped him. He also didn't have he's one of those guys that didn't have a father. His father was killed when he was a little kid, you know. And so he grew up, very rough around the edges. So when he told me he had cancer, and I kept thinking to myself, okay, if you actually do die, if hell is real, you're going to suffer forever, you know. So for whatever reason, I just kept saying, call Father Joseph. So I kept calling Father Joseph, calling Father Joseph, calling Father Joseph. And then Father Joseph wouldn't answer the phone and would return my phone calls. And I'm like, what's up with this Father Joseph? I thought he's supposed to be part of the church. I thought the church loves everyone. How can he not reply? You know, oh, yeah, we'll give him a message. We'll give him the message. We'll give him the message. And then I tell my wife, you know what? I'm going to do something. I'm going to offer Father Joseph $10,000. I didn't even have the money. I just made it up in my mind. I said, the church, all they want is money. That's all they care about is getting donations. So I'm going to offer him $10,000. And if he calls me back, tell him I'm going to have some money for him. If he calls me back, I know the church just wants money. And if he asks for it, I'm going to punch him in his face. Right? So I call the church. Okay, he's not here right now. He'll call you back. Guess what happened? You know, about an hour later, mm-hmm. he calls. Mm-hmm. And I told my wife, you see, I knew if I offered money, he'd call me back. You know, he ended up spending 5 hours with my friend. And his name, oddly, well, God doesn't do things out of coincidence. But my friend who's passed away, his name was Jesus. Oh. Jesus, mm-hmm. right? Jesus Chuito was his nickname. We used to call him Chuy. Encarnacion, incarnation, right? So he spent 5 hours with Chuy. And I couldn't believe that he was in there for so long. And he confessed to me. And Chuy had gotten to confession when he was 7. And at this point in time, he's about 31. You know, and that's the only time he had ever gotten a confession so he could receive his first communion. You know, so, and I remember joking with him, you're going to be in there for a long time. Father, I hope you're prepared, you know. And he's like, that's fine. It doesn't matter. You know, and he let everything out in confession. Thanks be to God, you know. So I asked Father, I said, hey, Father, have you eaten today? No, I haven't eaten. Okay, let's go get something to eat. He's like, I have to go to Long Island, go see someone else. But yeah, we could go stop by, get something to eat. And at the time, my wife was pregnant. And I remember he asked me, hey, are you married to the church? I said, no, but she wants to. And she goes, oh my gosh, I want to so badly, but he's so stubborn, you know. And he goes, I'll make you a deal. Okay, you're from the hood, right? So I know everyone from the hood likes a deal. And I promise you, you won't have to pay me anything. You don't have to give us nothing. I'll baptize your baby and I'll marry you on the same exact day. You get a 2-for-1 special. No one gets a 2-for-1 special. You know, that's better than a 99-cent store. And I said, I don't care. I'll marry her in a box. I said it before. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife became very, very happy. She goes, you need if you're saying yes, you better really do it. You better really do it. So I said, fine, I'll marry you. Don't worry about it. We went to the restaurant. And as we're at the restaurant, I said, hey, Father, I don't know if you're aware, but I have $10,000 for you. I have it on a check. You want it right now? And at this point in time, this is me trying to see if he just came for money and I was going to punch him in his face. Mm-hmm. And it's so crazy because God is working through him. Yeah. But the devil was working through me in the moment, mm-hmm. you know. And even though I said yes to something of God, like the negative influences were just still rolling around. Yeah. And he's like, no, why would I want $10,000 for? I don't do this for money. Like, the church doesn't do this for money. Like, I'm doing this because I want to save souls. I'm trying to bring people to Jesus. And I was like, what do you mean bring people to Jesus? Like, he's everywhere. He's like, yeah, he is everywhere, but it's different. You know, you need to come receive him in the Eucharist. You need to get go back to the church, get communion. And I was like, hey, I did my communion. He's like, no, You don't know what you're missing. And we had this entire dialogue about it. But he brought it in such a way that was so relatable.
Yeah.
He met me exactly where I was, you know, and it's so similar to like Jesus talking about fish and sheep and just becoming a regular human. And I joke with my 12-year-old son. I said, you know what? And Jesus probably stunk a little bit. And his friends probably made fun of him. You know, there wasn't really any soap back then. And he's like, Dad, you're talking about Jesus. I said, he's a human being. You know, I'm pretty sure he probably cracked jokes on his friends. So, you know, Father Jay, he reminded me, well, now looking back, you know, He reminds me of that, you know, of how Christ-like he was in the moment, meeting me where I was, you know, and trying to bring me back. I was that lost sheep that was astray.
Yeah.
And eventually he invited me to go to a retreat because my friend Chuito had passed away.
Yeah.
And before he had passed away, the day before he had passed away, he was in Chuito's bedside and he was telling him, you know, just let go. Just don't be afraid. You know, you're prepared. Because he had confessed him. He had given him the anointing of the sick, you know. And I remember Chuito's, some of his last words, kept saying, I'm scared, I'm scared, I'm scared. Mm. You know, and Father Joseph was literally right at his side, at his head, and had his arm around him. You know, he's like, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. God is waiting for you. Just, you know, let go. Your family's going to be fine. Everyone's going to be okay. You know, and I never forget that. And the guys that we were with were the same guys from childhood, the same group of guys, you know, the knuckleheads were all in a room at the same exact time. And when he was leaving, he invited all of us to go to retreat. He's like, I want all of you to come to a retreat. Please come to this retreat, you know. If you don't want to do it for yourself, do it for him. Come to the retreat, you know, pray for him. You know, you don't know how God's going to affect you and touch you. And we all agreed to go, all of us. But the only one that went was me.
Let's take a break there.
Yes.
And come out and find out what happened at that retreat.
Okay, no problem.
Powerful stuff there, Elvis. Right. Thanks for being We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Elvis's story. I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, got a whole archive of stories there. You're likely to find somebody from a similar background to you. And also send us a message. We'd love to be praying for you and with you on your journey as you explore the Catholic Church and follow where Christ is leading you. But be back in a couple minutes to hear the rest of Elvis's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Elvis Gutierrez, a Catholic revert. And we left out, you know, we left off, Elvis, you shared so many, you know, powerful, difficult experiences, you know. But when we left off, you know, you had just experienced the death of your cousin, right?
No, he's one of my close friends.
Close friends,
yeah,
right.
My cousin and my close friend.
Right, okay. Yes. And then and this encounter with the good father, who's invited you to go to a retreat, you and your friends, but you were the only one who attended. So mm-hmm. Pick us up from there. What happened next?
Yeah, so I ended up going to this retreat. Now, mind you, I still used to dress and act and, you know, very secularly, very worldly, and more so in an urban way, because I, you know, because of the whole music industry thing and wanting to become a famous person and this producer and all these other things, I was enamored with the way that people appeared. I thought everything had to be visual. So I was driving a Mercedes, I was wearing the fur coat, I had Gucci sneakers on, all these other things. So I show up to this retreat, I'm in the parking lot, and I'm wearing this leather jacket and a Mercedes, and everyone's just staring at me like, who is this guy? And you know, why are you here? And no one spoke to me. No one wanted to come and say hello to me. And I was like, well, what's wrong with these people? So I just stood in my car and I just blasting music, secular music at that, and I'm just blasting music, and then all of a sudden, some one guy just walks up to the car and says, hey, can I take a ride with you up to the retreat? I said, okay, yeah, no problem. He's like, yeah, it's a lot better to ride in this bad little yellow cheese bus. You know, so I don't want to ride the yellow bus. So can I ride in your car? I was like, yeah, that's fine. He's like, this is my wife. You know, can she ride with us too? I said, yeah, sit in the back seat. More, you know, the more the merrier. So as I'm riding with him, his name was Juan Espinal. God bless his soul. He passed away. Mm. As I'm riding with him, he starts asking me a bunch of questions. So where are you from? What's your, you know, why are you coming over here, et cetera, et cetera. This, my name is Juan. I'm actually from New York. I moved to Miami. And then I found out that we had a lot of friends in common. because he had grown up in the same neighborhoods that I grew up in. So, but the thing is that he used to be an enforcer for the Latin Kings or gang. And he had moved down to Miami. And when he had moved down to Miami, he had gotten into a lot of trouble. He had spent 5 years in prison for interstate trafficking and all these other crazy things. And then he eventually gave his life to God. And because he gave his life to God, now he's completely surrendered and he's serving God and doing, you know. So he just saw me, okay, well, no one wants to speak to him. And I'm not afraid of this guy. Why not? He's just like everyone else that I'm around. So he just sat in the car, and he and his wife, and we had this long conversation. And when I got to the retreat house, I was shocked. And it made absolutely no sense while I was there. First, I didn't want to go. But I said, okay, I need to do it in memory of my friend. So I need to at least fulfill my word, because if I say I'm going to do something as a man, I have to do it. And I get to this retreat house, and then Father Joseph says, hey, I didn't tell you this before, but this is a silent retreat. And I said, what? I said, what do you mean a silent retreat? Yeah, no one's going to speak to you. And you don't speak to anyone else. And I was like, what, you're setting me up? Like, this doesn't make any sense. He's like, it'll make sense by the end of the weekend. Don't worry about it. You know, but for right now, just relax. You know, I know you need it. And I was like, no. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it, please. You know, and I used to eat barbecue sauce with all my food. And he goes, listen, you know, my mom is in the back. She's going to be one of the people cooking over the retreat. And she has a bottle of barbecue sauce for you. You know, so put the barbecue sauce in the chicken if you want. You know, he's trying to kind of like butter me up and all these other things. So I'm in this retreat. And then I noticed when it was certain times when we couldn't speak, very rarely, like whisper, pass me the salt, mm-hmm. or things like that. Everyone is still completely away from me. And no one wanted to sleep in the same dorm as me. So the only person that slept in the dorm was myself, Father Joseph, and Juan. There were 15 other guys all crammed into one room. And I'm like, these guys are weird. They're like sleeping all over each other. And so it's my first instance of actually going to a retreat. I'm like, why would all these guys be packed on top of each other? They're so weird. They're probably going to smell. And I'm thinking all these weird thoughts in my mind. So fast forward, he's trying to show us a movie. And the nothing was working in this movie. The projector stopped working. Like the DVD player stopped working. Like you name it. Everything was just went on a fritz. So he said, you know what, I'll give you guys some downtime. You guys can talk. You know, I'll give you about 30 minutes to talk. So we just started speaking. So these two girls sat next to me and said, hey, we don't know who you are, but you're with Father Joseph the entire time. Can you like tell us a little bit about yourself? And I told them about my friend Chewy that passed away. And I gave them the entire story. And Juan's wife, her name is Olivia. Olivia, she didn't speak a word. You're talking about introvert. She's introverted to the extreme. She didn't say anything to anyone. I have no idea how they were married at all. And she heard my story. The only thing she said in the entire retreat, she turned around and she said, you know what? The entire time you thought you were trying to save your friend's soul, God was using him to save yours. That's why you're here. Hmm. And that dropped my jaw. And I was like, what did you say? And she goes, yeah. That's all she said, was yeah, and nodded her head and turned around and never spoke to me again.
Wow.
You know, and I ended up leaving the retreat, and my wife was like, how was it? My mom was like, my mom was ecstatic. How was it? How was it? Quiet, boring. And she's like, what? It's like, you didn't get anything? I was like, I don't know. It's not what I expected it. You know, I didn't have no Jesus moment. I didn't have anything happen, just, you know. This one girl said this one kind of crazy thing to me, and that's about it. And we didn't even get to watch TV. So that was my take on the retreat. So Father Joseph said, you know what? I want you to come to my youth group. Please start coming and volunteering to the youth group. I said, I already came to your retreat. Why do I need to go to the youth group for it? Just come for me, please. Just come for me. You know, there are a lot of kids from the neighborhood. You know, we're in a bad neighborhood. The parish isn't located in a neighborhood across the street. Was like, you know, drug spots and this, the same exact type of surroundings I grew up in. He's like, you understand these kids. So can you just please come? So I started showing up to the youth group. And then as I was there and I watched him with the interacting with the youth, I was like, wow, it reminded me so much of the Shepherd's Place youth group when I was with Tony. Mm. And I was like, wow, I missed this. This is something special that he has here. And he had me coming every single week. He's like, listen, don't worry about it. you're going to hang out with these people. You don't have to worry about it. And then Juan would show up all the time. And Juan was like, hey, come on, let's hang out. And Juan would take me under his wing. And then there's another guy named Carlos that started taking me under the wing as well. And Carlos was like Father Joseph's right-hand man. And he was a younger person. He's maybe like 20, 21 years old or so. And he stuck me with those two guys, you know, talking about the road to Emmaus, you know.
Yeah.
And as he stuck me with them, I started becoming like enamored in youth ministry. But then he tells me, okay, we're going to go to another retreat. This silent retreat was in January. Now the other retreat's in February, the youth retreat towards the end of February. I want you to go. No, I just gave up an entire weekend. I gave up 3 days and you sabotaged me, told me it's a silent retreat. Like, I didn't get to speak to anyone. But I promise you, this is not a silent retreat. You're going to have a lot of fun. It's a youth retreat. And I said, I don't know anything about this. He's like, you're going to be by my side. Don't worry about it. You know both of them. I had no idea that he put them next to me to put me under a microscope because I hadn't gone through any safe environment training. I hadn't done any of these things, you know. But he's like, I'm going to make sure that at all point in time, you're being watched, you're being observed, you're being walked with, mm-hmm. you know, you're being preached to, like that you're going to try to live this life. Mm-hmm. And he took a gamble on me. And nothing in me wanted to go to this retreat. Oh, my gosh. So he had a meeting about, you know, what, you know, you're going to be doing this duty or doing this duty. It's on a Thursday night. We had a holy hour, and I had no idea what a holy hour was.
Yeah.
And so I remember I was in the front, very front row of the chapel, and slowly I started moving a couple of seats back, moving a few seats back. Then I'm right at the door, right towards the end, and everything inside of me is like, don't go there. Why are you going to go there? These kids are bums. These kids, they'll punch you in their face. They'll rob you. All these negative thoughts are going to my mind, and I have no idea why. And I'm like, I'm not going to go to this retreat. I refuse to. So I had like this internal war going inside of me. And then all of a sudden, Father Joseph says, hey, Elvis, I have something for you. You know what? You could be a part of this play. I'm like, play? He's like, yeah, you could be a part of this play. I think you'll do great being a part of this play. You know? And as a matter of fact, can you please help us? We need you to serve some sandwiches and do all these other things. Like, in my mind, I'm like, serve sandwiches? They need to serve me. Like, I legitimately thought this because the whole arrogance of wanting to be in that music industry, things, you know, and the way that I lived before, the attention, I'm like, they need to serve me. And I was like, shut up. And I'm speaking to myself. I'm like, shut up. Like, look how cool the youth group is. And all is this complete internal war.
Yeah.
Then I said, okay, fine. I told my wife, you know what? Do you mind if I go? He invited me to go. And she goes, yes, go, please, go, go. And as I went to the retreat, he had me doing the same exact thing he told me to do. Serve some sandwiches, serve some juice. The entire time he's with me. And then when he had to take confessions, he said, hey, Juan, Carlos, stick with him. And they never left my side. Never. And you know, because I was staying with him in his room, he had a private bathroom. So at no point in time was I ever like interacting with the kids without like supervision. I had no idea this was happening. Mm. You know, right. I'm just thinking like, hey, they're my best friends now. I don't know. They're cool. But that retreat, so many powerful things started occurring. You know, I started seeing like kids loosen up and the kids like really becoming engaged, and he made me a part of this play, and I was like, hey, I enjoyed actually serving in youth ministry. Then Saturday night occurs, and Saturday night happens, we started going deep into worship, and he took out the Blessed Sacrament, and Jesus is exposed. And as Jesus is exposed, I'm like, okay, what's going on? And, you know, the kids start crying and all these other things, and I'm like, no one's hurting you. Like, why are you crying? What's happening? And no one's still speaking to me because at this point it's like sacred time. Like, okay, I learned, okay, just zip it and pay attention. As a matter of fact, why don't you start praying too? And I didn't know how to pray, so I just started talking. I was just like, I closed my eyes and I started speaking and I just started talking. And I had such a completely, if I could explain it, I would explain it, but I can't explain what happened. Yeah. All I know is that I heard God's voice. I physically felt God. Even though I can't explain how I felt God, but I know that I felt God because there's no other way. I know it's not my mind playing tricks on me because I thought my mind was playing tricks on me, you know. And the next day, Father Joseph was like, well, if you could explain it, it's not of God, you know. And God just met you where you were, you know. And, you know, you had an encounter. And I know you don't know what an encounter is, but you'll come to know it. Just keep going on the path. Keep going on the path. Trust me, keep going on the path. So, as I went down this rabbit hole, so to speak, of giving my life to God. That Sunday came in, and we played this little game, and they had the kids all blindfolded, holding onto each other's shoulders, and there's one kid in the front that wasn't blindfolded. Okay, you have to, you know, lead them to the path, and our job was to try to, like, make the kids lose their path. So, like, hey, be careful, you're going to step on a branch, give me your hand, and we're pulling them all astray. So the only one that actually held on maybe was the first kid holding onto the shoulders, you know. So at the end, Father Joseph's like, hey, take your headbands off, like bandanas off your eyes. And he saw how many kids had fallen away. He goes, this is what happens in the world. And this entire time, you never think Jesus walks with you, but he does walk with you. And he's been walking with you this entire time. And then he had Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament inside his hoodie. And he goes, look at Jesus right here. Look at the Lord. And he's been walking side by side with you. And this is what happens every day in your life, but you ignore it because you can't see it, you know. And I was like, this is crazy, you know. Then all of a sudden, he made a makeshift little altar in the woods, and he puts Jesus, places Jesus in the monstrance. As he places Jesus in the monstrance, he starts going around, and as he gets closer and closer and closer to me, I start breaking out into tears, and I start completely, like, shivering, and I have no idea why. But as he gets over to me and he places, you know, the Blessed Sacrament on my forehead, and I'm just, I'm crying. This is sobbing, sobbing, sobbing tears. And I'm like, what's happening to me? Like, after this, I was like, what just happened? I don't know what happened to me. So we go back into the cabin, and it goes, okay, everyone that's volunteering, we need you guys to go downstairs and fill out some papers for some rainy day bags. We want to give the kids some rainy day bags. Now, rainy day bags are little letters that we give the kids in case, like, you know, they feel bad on a bad day. They take it out. God loves you. Remember the retreat when you had this, you know, this experience. I showed up a little bit late, so there was only one other person down there, and they gave me, like, three little bags. Here's a pen. Here's some piece of paper. So I go through the bags, and the last bag that I see, it shocked me, and I started crying. And it said on the bag, Jesus, going down, and then it said Chewy. And I saw it said Chewy, and I never saw that in my life. And it went with that nickname, and I never met another person named Jesus. And there was another woman, her name was Francina, she was sitting on another table, and she saw me crying, you okay, you okay? And I was like, it's because of him. I'm here because of him. She's like, what do you mean? And I just, the tears, like, they're going on the piece of paper instead of me writing on it. Then I ended up getting a piece of paper, and I wrote the entire story of what happened and why I was there, and how much his name meant to me, and how much God is using him in this moment, in this rainy day bag, to help heal my heart. And that, you know, I'm going to give my life to God. I think you should give your life to God too, because if he could use you, this little piece of paper, to help me, you're going to help other people. I remember all these things that I wrote to him. It's supposed to be a tiny little note, and I wrote them this gigantic letter, you know. Wow. And then I asked Francina, who's the lady that brought this? This has to be a setup. And she goes, what lady? The lady with all the earrings. Oh, she had a bunch of earrings. Who? What's her name? Oh, that's Maria. Maria? Maria who? Maria Gutierrez. That's my mother's name. And I was like, what do you mean, Maria Gutierrez? Yeah, Maria Gutierrez. She's the one I brought it to. Then I just stood shut, and then I put my head down. And I was like, Maria's Mary. She brought me this Jesus, and I'm trying to equate everything. I'm just like, and I was just like, that's it. And I yelled out. I was like, that's it. I give up. Boom. I give up. I surrender. I'm done fighting you. And I remember looking up to the sky like, I'm done fighting you. I can't do this anymore. I just can't. I'm sorry. I give up. And as I said, I give up, and I surrendered. A peace came over me. You know, so much peace came over me, and still a lot of tears. Yeah. And I'm kind of trying to hold back the tears right now as I say it. Yeah. But a lot of tears were flowing. And then I ended up returning back home to my wife, and my mom was there waiting for me. And then they asked me the question again, how was the retreat? I didn't say a word. And I told my mom, I surrender. I give up. And my mom bursted out crying. And she started praising God. Oh, my God, thank you so much for all these nights that I thought that, you know, you were going to die because I show up maybe 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. I was going to die. My mom's praying the rosary until I showed up back home. And my wife's saying, you know, can we get married in the church now? And eventually, thanks be to God, I did get married in the church, you know, and I baptized my son the same day.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Powerful stuff, man. Yeah. We're running out of time. We have about 5 minutes left here. So okay. Powerful experiences. What happened after that? And what are you doing now?
What happened after that is a complete, this is a part two.
There's a lot. Yeah.
And it'll probably take like another hour or so for me to fully explain it. But God has been very, very good in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I had a son that was born. I ended up having a daughter as well. You know, Eliang, you know, his name is after myself and my wife. Yeah. That means God is family. My daughter's name was supposed to be Marielis, which spelled Marie, M-A-R-I-E, Liz. But we ended up switching it to her middle name. And it was supposed to be named after the Virgin Mary and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. So, and we tried to perform it into Spanish. So we tried to be like have a holy name. I ended up getting engaged into youth ministry. I ended up becoming a catechist, even though I had no idea how to pray. But oddly enough, the one prayer that I did remember was the act of contrition that I learned when I was 7 years old. And it never disappeared. I forgot the Our Father. I forgot everything you can think of. But the act of contrition, I remembered. And I dropped out of college twice, but then I eventually went back to school. You know, in my early 30s, I went back to school and I graduated college, magna cum laude. And I said, God, I don't know what you want to do, but I'm just yours. Whatever you want, I'm going to go down this path with you. And I eventually attained my bachelor's degree, and I became an actual legitimate Catholic high school teacher teaching theology. And in that process, I obtained my master's in theology. And as I obtained my master's in theology, like I'd already had gained other heroes. Growing up, my heroes were like Tupac and Rustlers and all these, and the guys from the south side of the street corners. Then my heroes became Patrick Madrid and Scott Hahn. And I was very appreciative of the formation that, the informal formation I received on YouTube with Dr. Robert Fustigi. And I was like, you know what? Thank you so much. And I became a theology teacher. And right now I'm working at Crystal Ray Tampa Salesian High School in Tampa, Florida. I'm in love with the mission. You know, I can see myself in those kids, and those kids, they deserve every little thing. This graduating class, it was this very small school. We had 200 kids there. So this graduating class had 39 kids in it, and they gained over $5 million in scholarships. You know, we have a success team, mental health team, you know, specifically for the kids. You know, we have retreats for them. I'm just enamored with the school and what the school does. We have a corporate work study program that helps them pay their tuition, so they only pay $75 a month. So that school is a godsend, not just for the kids, but for the entire community and what they do for those families. And they're trying to transform these kids to try to break them out of the cycle of poverty permanently and hopefully transform the city, you know, one generation at a time. Yeah. You know, so the church has been very good. God has been very good to me. And Father Joseph actually became Bishop Joseph Espaillat.
Oh, wow.
He's now an auxiliary bishop of New York. So, and he ended up becoming my son's godfather. So I also joined his ministry for 5 years. And he's my brother. He's my brother. He's my spiritual father. He's very important in my life. And, you know, God bless him. God bless, you know, his mission and the Charismatic Center of the Bronx, New York, and the Parish St. Anthony de Padua. And, that's where I am.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, it sounds like an amazing ministry there, teaching those kids. Anything you want to shout out to the kids there?
Well, I like to shout out the administration, because these people, they sacrifice themselves. And the crazy thing is that the kids have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But our principal, he's Batman, because you give him enough data, he'll be able to solve anything. You know, his name is Matt Toronto. He's an amazing administrator, amazing person. Our dean of curriculum, Kelly Larson, she's a godsend. For one point in time, I thought I wasn't too smart. I was like, I'm not smart enough to work in this school. But they've they allow you the opportunity to become a better educator, not just only help the kids, but they help overall. So I want to shout them out. I want to shout out, you know, everyone behind the scenes, even the bus drivers, the janitors, everyone that really helps the school become the school. And everyone else in general, just understand that God can take your mess and turn it into a message. That's it. And the entire Catholic hip-hop community, because God replaced one thing with the other one.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for them as well.
Well, thank you so much, Elvis, for your story, now for your great work, and for being here to share your witness.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Elvis' story was an inspiration to you. Actually, a written version of the story with probably a lot of details that didn't make it on the show tonight can be found at chnetwork.org/story. His story is entitled Return from Hell, so check that out. In the meantime, we'll be back again next week with another story. God bless you.